subcommittee of the subcommittee. This morning we're having three public hearings. House Bill 2942, House Bill 2637, and House Bill 3615. We'll open the public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2942. Representative Lundquist, would you come forward, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Appreciate you hearing this bill. I understand, I realize the session is getting late, but I very appreciate that because I believe this is a bill that sets some policy that will come out of this session as one of the good policy decisions that we've made. The premise of this bill, 2942, is simply that the state should lessen its addiction to lottery over time. We're not talking about the addiction of individual people. We're talking about the state's addiction to lottery. And all of us have been around, and obviously some of you have been around a lot longer than I have, understand that the lottery has become a resource that we depend upon, and there's a significant number of people that question the validity of that. When we look at the lottery, the first thing we need to do is we need to take out those kinds of funds that are already dedicated. And the major ones that you have are the Education Endowment Fund that Senator Smith started. This last time we had the Parks and Recreation, the Salmon, those kind of dedicated. And obviously there's other dollars that are dedicated for repayment of debt that are already out of that. So what we did is we went to the Revenue Department and asked what is the appropriate number that in this biennium is what I call discretionary spending. And if you'll notice on this third bullet there, it talks about that, that the resources in this biennium are $341.9 million. What we are suggesting through this bill is to cap what we call discretionary spending at $350 million. And that will then not affect this biennium. In succeeding bienniums, we reduce that cap by 5%. Excuse me. So that over time, we would lessen our addiction to the lottery as a source of resources. The additional amount that comes in over the cap and after the other funds that I've already spoke about would be placed in the Common School Fund. And I place it in that fund because that is a constitutionally protected fund. It's not a fund that the legislature will raid easily. As you know, the earnings from that particular fund are used for education. And so I think we accomplished two things here. We not only lessen the addiction to the lottery, at the same time increase the ability to provide a quality education for all of our students. We have worked with the governor's office, the treasury department, the lottery department, and economic development department, and all of those departments have worked with them and are supportive of this, bill. Also, very quickly, that has passed the House 46-1 with had a lot of members off the floor. I have talked to President Adams about this. He is very, very supportive of this concept. In fact, last session, for those of you that were here, remember that the rainy day fund that we proposed, we passed out of the House, went to the Senate. And this was one of the methods of funding the rainy day fund. The Senate sent back to the House only this portion, which gives you some indication of how strong the Senate felt about the fact that this was a good policy. As I've worked around the state, I have heard many, many times the fact that the lottery is a source of funding that maybe we need to take another look at. Should we be so reliant on that as a particular source? I'll just close by saying this. I know of no real opposition to the bill. We work with the Restaurant Association, that group that deals with the retailers that deal with the lottery, and because we are not impacting that part of the lottery, they are not in opposition as well. So I believe it is a positive policy for the state of Oregon, and if a person believes that we ought to become less reliant. You would like this bill. If you believe that you ought to become more reliant on the lottery, you will probably not like this bill. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd ask to answer any questions.
Great, thank you. Are there any questions? Senator Lynn.
It's a reducing the 5% every biennium. That from the $306 million or any balance of it out of the balance of 5%, or which is the amount we are reducing the 5%?
Now, Mr. Chairman, Senator Lim, the 5% would come off of $350 million, and it's 5% every time thereafter. So it's not 5% of $350. It is the first biennium, and after that it would be $332.5 million. The succeeding biennium would be $315 million because you take 5% of that new cap every time. So it takes a considerable period of time before you would work this down to, nearly zero. Theoretically, you never would because you only take 5% of a figure.
So never ending, the amount will be there always.
Right. And one thing I didn't mention, Mr. Chair, if I might, one of the reasons that the Water Department likes this particular aspect is because, as you realize, we appropriate 100% of the lottery projected dollars every biennium, and we spend that. We allocate 100% of the appropriated amount. They have no ending balance. And if you recall, in 1995, we were called back in a special session because the lottery went down. And any time the lottery projections for the actual lottery amounts come in are less than projected, all of those agencies that take lottery dollars have to make some adjustments. But this does sort of have to build in any balance, if you would. And of course, if the amount that comes in is not as great, let's take next biennium. Let's say that $332 million is the cap, and $335 come in, then only $3 million would go into the common school fund. In other words, we still allow that cap. So it has a sort of a floating imbalance that the Water Department likes as well.
Okay, follow-up question. Senator Lim.
And we have dedicated funding constitutionally for the education and then the salmon and hog. That doesn't count into this one. This is only after that this amount.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lim, that's correct.
Okay. And one more question.
Yes, please.
And thank you very much for mentioning the state addition to this lottery. But that this bill doesn't take away any addition. Only the that we use the fund from something else, but has nothing to do with the state addition to the lottery at all. Nothing to do with it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lim, I guess my response to that would be this. I believe it does lessen the state's addiction because the money that goes in the common school fund, that doesn't have to go in there. We have not been putting that in times past. It's the discretionary spending, I think, is where our addiction really is. The addiction is the fact that we need, and so I think that lessens that aspect of it. It's true, Senator Lim, that the total dollars would choke them, but at some point, I believe the state then can make a decision. If they want to do away with the lottery, and a lot of people want to do that, and not say, well, we have to continue because there's money going to the common school fund. I don't believe that. It's the discretionary spending that I see is where the addiction is less.
Final question is yes, sir. Maybe my question maybe not, that's not exactly connected to this one, but indirectly tonight. So I have a bill to take away the gambling advertisement that my review. Some of the state revenue, and how do you feel about it?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Lim, my premise is that over time we need to lessen addiction. Now, there may be some other ways to do that, so I'm all for any way we can do to lessen that addiction of the state.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you, Representative. The question I do have is, are there any amendments that need to be considered for this bill?
There are not any, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Staff, would you like to make any comments?
Yeah, yes, Mr. Chair. As I read the bill, it's the net of the constitutionally dedicated reductions plus any debt service. Is that correct? Okay.
So debt service would not be impacted?
Yes, that's true. That's how we, Mr. Chairman, that's how we came to that figure.
Okay.
And we were very careful in trying to come to a figure that is an appropriate figure, with the Treasury Department and with the Economic Development.
Okay. Okay, Graham Patrick?
Sir, I just wanted to say, and I told Brooks on a blank question, if I have some concerns now, especially with what the games that are being played currently with the Common School Fund that's going on, and putting this money in the Common School Fund, but the legislature doesn't have control over it. The Common School Fund is controlled by the Secretary of State, Treasurer's Office, and the Governor, as the three officers in terms of the Common School Fund and how they make and how they put some of those things forward, is my understanding. Now in the budget negotiations, my understanding is that we've looked at $40 million. There was then a $50 million that was voted by the Democrat caucus, but they felt that because the governor, secretary of state, and treasurer controlled that they would they could get that, but only if the school funding number met their expectation level. So I felt like the legislature was really held hostage as a result of that number. I do not want to support this as a result of the games that are being played with the Common School Fund. Just wanted to put that on the record as to why I think if the legislature had some ability to control that, I would be more in favor of it. But at this point in time, I'm not in favor of doing this in this manner.
Do you have any response you want to give to that?
Mr. Chairman, very passage. My response is simply this, is that this is a rather small amount that's going in the Common School Fund. The initial process has done way more to the lottery than in the legislature's discretion through the Education Endowment Fund, through the Foster Salmon Plan. So I, and put that in the relative terms, this is much smaller piece in the game for quite a while period of time than that. That's probably smart.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify to House Bill 2942? Yes, Ken. Come forward, please, and identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, excuse me, my name is Ken Armstrong, Executive Director of the Oregon Public Courts Association. I'm here this morning in a somewhat uncomfortable position of opposing House Bill 2942. It is a bill that didn't come to our attention until after it passed the House, and so we're, I suppose you could say, somewhat late into this process, but we're here nonetheless to say that we have been concerned and continue to be concerned with the continual erosion over the years of the use of lottery dollars for economic development programs, which was the premise under which that was established. As courts, of course, that's our bread and butter. We are able to put infrastructure in the ground, construct buildings, et cetera, to stimulate job creation and bolster the economies in both the rural and the urban parts of the state. And it's through the lottery dollars, through the Economic Development Department primarily, and also through the Department of Transportation. Actually, that's not so much true with the Economic Development Department, that we're able to get those projects constructed. Our feeling is that by spending more of these dollars to the Common School Fund and then seeing that amount of discretionary revenue decreased over coming bienniums is going to further erode our ability to have that discretionary money through the legislature to come and make an argument to you that we need to be able to make some investments here. So we think that this is a troubling measure. We certainly don't oppose the notion that we want to have as much funding as we can for education, but we also feel that there's a real imperative for the state of Oregon, particularly in good times, to make investments for when those bad times come, And that's what I want to represent here. Again, I'll emphasize, the lottery was established originally for economic development. That has been eroded. It is continuing to be spread out to other needs, which are, I'm not debating the need on these other areas, but it's not what it was originally created for. And I'd just like to remind the committee of that, and would encourage the committee to keep maximum flexibility with its discretionary resources, which is the lottery.
Thank you. I would also share with the committee that although the lottery was designated for economic development, it left the decision up to 90 legislators to define what economic development is. So the initiative petition that was founded, although it addressed economic development, didn't specify what economic development is. So that's part of the problem over the last 10, 12 years is had no real definition.
You need to have it, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, it's kind of like one of those jackrabbits from Eastern Oregon.
Remember with them?
Yeah.
I thought when Representative started talking about the games that are being played for the common school fund, I thought maybe it was indicating it could be a new scratch off game in the common school fund.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would also point out that there was a vote of the people not that long ago to make education funding also a primary purpose of the lottery funds. But I would also point out that right now, of the discretionary dollars that are in the lottery fund, over 80% of that is currently going to schools. So to some extent, you would be locking away resources that you are currently spending for schools anyhow.
Okay. All right. Further questions? Thanks, Kim. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2942? If not, Wally, is there any comments you'd like to make on this state treasurer's part? I won't say that you made him up previously. Welcome
to the Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Raleigh Wisbrock, Chief of Staff of the Treasury. Our interest in the bill is very narrow, and it just relates to the impact on the bonds and our ability to pay the bonds. And there is no impact in the bill on our ability to pay our bonds, and we're comfortable with that aspect of it.
Okay. Could you give an indication how much impact it might be in the future on bonding? Maybe there's no impact now, but say, let's look at 15 years down the road, because this is going to be phased in over 20 years. But let's look down the road 15 years. And we have potential requests for bonding authority. Is there going to be a direct impact?
Mr. Chair, as I understand it, no, that we would have the ability to continue to issue debt, and that everything would be subtracted from that. I'm looking at staff, and I respect that analysis. That was our understanding of how it worked.
Okay.
And, Mr. Chair, we brought our debt manager, Mr. Smith, in, walked through the bill. Those are some of the questions that we asked when we analyzed it, and Mr. Smith was very comfortable we would maintain our ability to issue lottery-backed debt in the future.
Okay.
And we have no specific concerns about that.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? Not, is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2942? We'll close the hearing on House Bill 2942, and we'll wait upon arrival of some members to see what final action must be taken on 2942. Open the hearing on House Bill 2637. You want to have a listening moment? Rick, would you like to start off and explain what this bill does?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2637 would exempt vehicles from emission testing if the vehicle is registered in Columbia or Yamhill County, and if the owner makes a sworn statement that the vehicle is not used to commute to work in Multnomah, Washington, or Clackamas County. You also have before you a fiscal impact statement which was revised on July 6th, which shows a decrease in other fund revenues of $282,000. This is as a result of 13,500 fewer vehicles being tested. DQ provided some fiscal information that increased expenditures by over $600,000, primarily for enforcement. However, LFO believes that law enforcement agencies would probably not undertake the responsibility of enforcement requirements, therefore eliminating these expenditures. Under this bill, if a vehicle owner makes a false sworn statement, they could be charged with a Class A misdemeanor, which carries a maximum jail sentence of 1 year and up to $5,000. The bill does have a sunset date of January 1st, 2003, and that's it.
Okay, are there any questions that committee members have staff? Representative Patridge.
Mr. Chair, the current state of the law in terms of for this particular airshed or area in regards to the testing?
The definition is used in the air quality maintenance area. As you know, in Jackson County, you can live on the same street as your neighbor and be in and be out. And what this has done is geographically set a map for us that says even in Yamhill County, he's considered as part of the air quality maintenance area and be included in the vehicle inspection. What this is supposed to do is there's a county classified thing, or one of the other counties in the northwest corner of the state, plus Yamhill, they're currently under this, and what they do is exempt them out if they identify that they don't drive into that area. It's something we've stopped for years for the people in Southern Oregon.
I was just wondering how big the circle was going on in the northern part of the
state. Well, we have a person from DEQ here to answer the technical questions, so you come up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Greg Green. I'm the Air Quality Administrator for DEQ. You were wanting to know the size of the boundary? Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, the air quality airshed for the Portland region includes most of the large jurisdictions in Washington, Multnomah, and Clackamas County. It goes as far south as about the Tualatin area, as far as north all the way to, it actually goes up into north of Vancouver. Then east, I think it goes as far as about Hillsborough.
So the question that the representative was trying to ask is, how many counties outside the three are included in the air quality maintenance area?
Mr. Chair, Representative Patrick, none. The only other place that we have a vehicle inspection program in the state is in the Medford region. But there's no other counties in the Portland region outside of Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington County that are included in the airshed in Oregon.
Where is Yamhill County at?
Mr. Chair, Representative Patrick, perhaps I should clarify that a little bit. Yes, Yamhill, there is a very small portion of Yamhill County and a very small portion of Columbia County also.
I just wondered how many counties were, who was this affecting?
Yeah,
so.
Well, we wouldn't have this bill, Mr. Chair, unless somebody else.
That's the point I was trying to raise, that follow up on your question. And there's two counties that are affected, Columbia and Yamhill, right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Now, Columbia County and Yamhill County aren't actually part of the airshed, but they are included in the vehicle inspection program.
Okay. Further questions, Representative Schrader.
If they're not part of the airshed, why are they included in the vehicle inspection program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, the reason they're included in the airshed is that when the Portland region was out of compliance with air quality standards, the way we brought it back into compliance was to we put some fairly stringent controls on industry, but we also started a vehicle inspection program back in the late 70s. And we eventually came into compliance with air quality standards in the late 1980s, but to remove the formal designation that the EPA had given us, what we had to do is we had to develop what we called a 10-year maintenance plan that showed that we would stay in compliance with air quality standards for 10 years. And the strategies that were included in that plan, the pollution reduction strategies, were developed by a task force appointed by Governor Roberts and then refined by two task forces back during the 1993 and 95 legislative session. Those task forces were chaired by Representative Bryan. One of the strategies that they directed us to implement was to look at areas outside of the airshed where there was quite a bit of people who commuted into the airshed for work and thus contributed to the problem and include those as part of the vehicle inspection program. So what we did is we looked at those areas that had a fairly high commute rate. I think we drew the line at 40%. And if over 40% of the workforce commuted into the airshed, then we included those areas into the vehicle inspection program, and that's how we got the small parts of Columbia and Yamhill counties as part of the program.
Yes, please. So I assume that the reason this bill is before us is because less than 40% from those two counties now commute early. Do we have a current percentage?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, not entirely, and Representative Willis will go into that some more when she testifies. The problem is that even though there's a greater than 40% of the people who are commuting into the airshed and even a far greater number coming to the airshed to work or to play and go to restaurants and things like that, not everybody in those areas does come into the airshed, and there's no black and white way to exempt people who don't commute into the airshed from the program.
Sure. Yes. Well, why aren't areas of Clackamas County that don't, or people that in Clackamas County that don't commute and are not currently airshed exempted?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, just because the people who commute into the airshed from those areas was less, for work was less than 40%. Initially, when the legislature decided that they were going to implement this policy, they had the intention themselves of drawing the boundaries on which areas would actually be included in the airshed. And the first attempt was just to say, okay, everybody in Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties would be included in the airshed. But then people at places like government camp and places like that, you know, kind of raise their hand and say, well, you know, it doesn't make sense to include us in there just because we're part of those counties. And so the legislature couldn't really come up with a good way of doing that, so they kind of tapped the EQ to do it. And eventually what we settled on was this commute rate figure of 40% to include, you know, that we would use to include people in the airshed.
Yeah. I guess what I was driving at, though, was that I assume that there's parts of Clackamas and Washington County that are not really in the airshed but have greater commuter rates, and yet some of those same people, actual individuals, don't commute into Portland from those areas, and I assume they're still having to get their vehicles tested. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, not that I know of. We look fairly closely at all the local small towns outside of the airshed, even those within those three counties that actually commuted into the airshed, and I can't think of any off the top of my head where the commute rate is greater than 40%. Does that answer your question?
Not exactly, because I can think of community that's included and is not in the airshed, but as I understand the airshed is being drawn, maybe I'd have to see a revised map of the airshed. But I assume that the reason they're in is because of the commuter thing, or they're part of Clackamas County, and therefore have to get tested, and yet in reality, a lot of those people don't even commute to Portland. They get to stay home or stay at home.
Good, good question. Senator Yee.
Mr. Chairman, what was
the EQ's position
regarding this exemption?
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, we opposed the exemption. And the reason is, it's not necessarily because we don't think it makes sense to find a way to exempt people who don't commute into the airshed. But the problem is that in the plan that we submitted to EPA, the pollution reduction strategies that are included in that plan have to be what we call enforceable and quantifiable. And what that means is that we have to have a mechanism in place to make sure that if a person, for instance, signs an exemption that says they don't commute into the airshed, that we have a method of coming back and following up and make sure that they, in fact, don't commute into the airshed. And we've looked at this issue a number of times over the last 3 or 4 years, and we just couldn't come up with a good, cost-effective way to enforce the rule and to make sure that this very small portion of this population that says they're not commuting into the airshed really isn't. And really the best we could do is this enforcement mechanism that's the reason why we're here this morning. And kind of one of the things that was proposed was to issue a special sticker for those people in the airshed that they could put on their car when they registered it, which says, I never commute into the airshed. And then if that sticker is ever seen in Portland, for instance, they could be ticketed for coming into the airshed. The problem is that that's just, you know, it's just such an extremely costly way to do it that it didn't make sense financially to do that. Plus the fact that, as Mr. Olson said, it's highly improbable that the state police or any other police force would actually take the time to do that. That's just not high on their priority list. So what we're dealing with a very small group of people here that we just really don't have a mechanism to ensure that they are, in fact, not coming into the airshed as they say they're not.
Okay.
I thought this was about commuting, not coming into the airshed. I mean, I hope that we haven't gotten so far down the road that we're worried about people driving into the airshed that may not have had their vehicle tested.
Mr. Chair, Senator Tom, what this bill is about is
what the bill's about. What you just said, that somebody would, are we talking about commuting back and forth to work into the airshed? Or are we talking about ever coming into the airshed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tom, we drew the line. When we drew the line, what we did is we based it upon the number of people who actually commute into the airshed for work. But that doesn't change the fact that there are a great number of people who come into the airshed for other reasons, and it doesn't make any difference what you come into the airshed for. You're still contributing to the pollution problem.
But if you come 5 or 6 days a week, it is a great deal of difference than coming once a month to have dinner.
Mr. Sheriff Henry, you said that's correct.
Mm-hmm. My point is that having somebody put a sticker on their car and say they never come in, first of all, would be a fallacy, because there'd be people from California, my brother and sister-in-law who live in San Francisco, do come into Portland once in a while. My sister that lives in Seattle comes into Portland. So we can't restrict movement like that. And I do understand what this bill is about, but the point is that it's about people commuting back and forth, not coming into the airshed, as I understand it. So there should be a way to be able to find out if somebody works within the airshed. And that is very different than coming in for other purposes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Chief Carb, you're right, and there's a way to do it. It's just very, very expensive to do.
Any further questions? Representative Beck. Have you ever talked about just doing this statewide?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, we have. The problem with that is that there's really only 3 or 4 cities in the state who have the type of air pollution problems that it would make sense to do this kind of program for. Last year, we had 4 areas of the state that actually exceeded air quality standards, and that was Portland, Eugene, Salem, and Medford. Medford actually had the worst air quality in any place in the state last year. But outside of those 4 areas, it just doesn't make sense to implement a vehicle inspection program.
The one thing you didn't say was, if we could find a way to legislate the weather, we'd have the cleanest air in the state. Representative Beck, is there any state that does this
on principle, but on the notion that we all know cars are one of the biggest polluters, and we all own cars, and to some extent maybe there's a personal responsibility we all have to take for putting a little bit of pollution into the air, whether we live in a polluted airshed or not. Maybe if we live in a polluted airshed, we pay a little more to do it. But has there been any thought of just setting up the program, letting everybody pay something, and charging those of us who choose to live in polluted places significantly more, but at least start having everybody own up to the fact that they use technology that causes a little pollution? Is there any state that does this? Have we ever talked to some kind of graduating level here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, there are a number of states that have statewide testing, a number of East Coast states and California that Senator Utah mentioned. As a matter of fact, California's pollution problems are so bad that they kind of have their own air quality regulations that are far more stringent than what they are on a federal level. One of the things that the EPA has recently promulgated is a new rule to limit the amount of sulfur in gasoline. And what they're proposing is to limit the amount of sulfur in gasoline to 30 parts per million on a nationwide basis. And if they did that, just in the Portland-Salem region alone, that would be equivalent to taking over 500,000 cars off the road. And that's the same amount of pollution reduction that we get from a vehicle inspection program. So the argument can be made, and the oil industry is trying to make the argument that we don't need that low sulfur gasoline here on the western part of the United States. But the argument can be made that with that gasoline, we could do away with the vehicle inspection program entirely just because we'd be getting the same pollution reduction from low sulfur gasoline that we're getting from the vehicle inspection program.
Okay, no further questions. If not, thank you very much. And Senator Eves.
Can you say that a written statement regarding the opposition and the reason, and give us a revised map of the airshed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, yes, I'll provide a copy of the testimony that we provided to the Senate Rules Committee, and I'll also provide you a copy of the map for the that shows specifically where the airshed is out written.
Okay. Representative
Green is still here. When he talks about maybe the low sulfur gas and then change, that would be the equivalent of that change of a -1.5 million automobile vehicles. How many total vehicles are we talking about that are subject to this question, President?
Mr. Chair, Representative, right now we test about 500,000 vehicles every 2 years.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 2637?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Hagerbaumer. I'm the Air and Transportation Program Director at the Oregon Environmental Council, and we thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. We do oppose House Bill 2637. First, just to say, ozone pollution really is a very serious health issue, and there's a growing body of evidence that shows that there's really no safe level of ozone or particulate matter pollution in the air, so we ought to be doing more to clean up our air as opposed to less. The Portland region is actually barely in compliance with federal air quality standards for ozone and must be very vigilant in controlling these emissions. So it has the vehicle inspection program as one of its components, and that's the largest component and the most effective component in doing so. It's true that vehicles that are driven primarily outside of the maintenance area pose less of a threat to the air quality than the vehicles that are driven inside of the boundary, but the fact remains that ozone also travels great distances. It's been determined that the emissions from Scappoose contribute to ozone exceedances in Oregon City, which is inside of the non-attainment area. And in other parts of the country, smog has been proven to travel hundreds of miles. So East Coast air pollution problems are very highly driven by pollution in the Midwest, for example. Basically, House Bill 2637 exempts drivers from the emissions testing program based on their commuting behavior. But as was mentioned earlier, many residents outside of the area do regularly drive their vehicles into the non-attainment area for other purposes like shopping or school or entertainment. And it could be more than once a week that they're doing that. In order to implement this bill, DEQ would need to somehow be able to enforce it. And this bill does not really show an enforcement mechanism that is quantifiable or that the police would do anything about. So the legislature would actually be adding to DEQ's workload while simultaneously cutting its budget in other areas that you all are discussing. And the state wouldn't receive any air quality benefit whatsoever from this bill. The sponsors of House Bill 2637 do wish to relieve their residents of the burden of emissions testing, but it's really hard to believe that it's true of more than a handful of people that they never drive into the Portland metropolitan area to come and get your car tested once every 2 years can hardly be construed as a very large burden. As Representative Beck mentioned earlier, it's kind of our public duty to drive vehicles that are as low polluting as possible. So we urge you to keep the inspection and maintenance program intact. And when the point comes that we have low sulfur fuel or other better mechanisms to do so, we can ditch it all together. But until that's the case, I think we really need to keep the programs that work in place. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. What is the chief component of the pollution from automobiles?
Mr. Chair, I believe volatile organic compounds and carbon monoxide. CO2 is a different issue.
Okay, but carbon dioxide?
Right, carbon monoxide.
Okay, do trees emit pollution?
The trees can actually grab certain pollution, like
do trees emit pollution?
Mr.
Have you ever heard of the Great Smoky Mountains?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
You know why they're smoky? Pollution. Out of the pine needles. They create pollution. So to say that pollution is caused by the Midwest on the East Coast is stretching my imagination beyond my ability to imagine.
Mr. Chair, that's the ozone that travels from the Midwest to the East Coast. It's very well proven.
Well, there's a lot of BS that travels, too. are there any questions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, I just want to make sure our witness broke her arm falling off one of those evil bicycles. She's driving cars, polluting the air.
Okay, thank you very much. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on this? It's a bassinet representing Representative Lewis. I understand she's on her way to the Capitol, and we'll just go ahead and
she'll be here in 15 minutes. I'm Tom Bessonette. I'm a legislative assistant for Representative Lewis. I'd like to bring you a little bit different approach on this. For the first time, I've heard Mr. Green indicate that 40% of the people work within that area. That means 60% of the people that live in that area have to have their vehicles tested, and that's not fair. For one thing, under motor vehicle, Department of Motor Vehicle sends a renewal certificate to everybody in the Newburgh zip code. They can then say on that notification that they don't live within the mapped area to have their vehicle tested. I'm rather excited about this because I'm frustrated. I worked for Representative Lewis as a volunteer starting October last year. In November, we received the first map to indicate what area was in fact included in the testing zone. So everybody was calling her office saying, do I have to have my vehicle tested? And we were unable to tell them until November which side they lived on. Now, I think that's very poor workmanship on the behalf of one of our state governments. I don't know which one. Most of the vehicles that are commuting are newer vehicles because obviously people who commute drive more miles. They wear out their vehicles. And so this testing applies more or less to the older people, as Representative Lewis will share with you when she gets here. But as a volunteer for her, I was plagued with people calling in and saying, do I have to have my vehicle tested? And they don't go into... those who drive in should be tested on a regular basis as an employee within that area. They should be tested, and they're willing to be tested. But those who live out, live in there, in the 60% should not have to be tested.
What's your name, sir? Okay. Anyone else have questions? Senator Keaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just thinking about following up on this idea of people who work in the region. It seemed to me that if there was a way of having somebody produce their pay stub or something, it could be pretty easily determined where somebody works. Now, I know some people work for themselves or whatever, and not everybody is working, and particularly if they're retired. You know, that would be something if they aren't in the airshed and don't really make that many trips into Portland or within the airshed. Has there been thought given to the kind of enforcement that might be, not enforcement, but I guess identifying those that really truly do work and commute on an ongoing basis?
I'm sure there's been a lot of thought given to a lot of areas on this because it's been a problem for quite a while. I've always felt that self-certification would be in order. The DEQ in the past, as I've heard them testifying, has said there's no way to enforce that, and the enforcement is the problem with self-certification. I don't know when we give up trusting our people in self-certification, but apparently we have. Or at least DEQ has.
Okay, further questions?
Okay.
Senator Lynn.
I'm not sure if this should address you, but do you have a exemption for the DEQ system for senior citizens in living in this metro area?
Not Medford. Everybody is affected across the board, regardless of what your status is.
You should give an exemption to senior citizens. I'm becoming a senior citizen myself.
Okay. All right, further questions, Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure to whom the question should be directed, but the issue really doesn't get to the heart of another potential problem, and that is we commute more and more, we commute longer distances, and there may be people that live outside and commute through some of these areas to another area. And I don't know how that affects this particular issue, but as we've heard testimony of additional people commuting, Representative Beck has brought up the issue where maybe this will address a portion of it, but I know that in other states where they have mandatory testing statewide, sometimes those are fraught with all kinds of fraud and other problems. I, as a college student, I attended university in a state which required mandatory vehicle emissions testing and two or three other things to make sure that your lights were properly reflecting the right spot and those kinds of things. The first two stations that I went to get the testing done, they said everything was wrong and needed hundreds of dollars worth of work, and the third place I went to charged me the $15 sticker and did the testing, and everything was fine. So you just shop around until you find what you need, I guess. So that's just an observation I had. There's sometimes those programs are fraught with all sorts of problems. I don't want to go there, but it is an issue as we commute more and more.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions or comments? Now we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2637. Actually, what we're going to do is recess it because Representative Lewis is on her way here, and so she can testify. Senator Dave?
Put my two cents worth in, Mr. Chair. My name's on this bill.
as it has been every session for a few of them now. And
that's why we were questioning this.
Well, that's why. I was just on the Public Affairs Committee, and so I missed, and I don't know what testimony you've heard. We've been battling this for some time since it started. It's really unfair. I have constituents who are driving, 25 miles to get their cars tested who don't even take those vehicles into the Portland metropolitan area. They may go to work in the other direction in Wana, over in Longview. And it's not exactly a big enough city to be a, a city that you just sort of cruise. We were promised when they did the hearings in Scappoose, by the hearings officer, that we would have a testing site in Scappoose. And a lot of people said, okay, if we have to pay, fair dues, so to speak, at least it's a, and they've never given us one. In fact, they closed the closest one to Scappoose. So they just keep pushing it out further and further. So we have to drive to Portland and create more air emissions.
I have a question. Representative Scott, Senator Duke, you say you've had this bill for three sessions.
That is great.
Has the governor vetoed it?
Every single time.
The governor vetoed
it. Every single time. Last session, they told me if DEQ wrote the amendment, we were okay. And the staff said he would sign it, and DEQ wrote the amendment. And they kept telling me that right up to the point where they handed me the veto letter.
Maybe one way to solve this problem is to privatize the air emission testing. So a DEQ would write rules, so anybody who does auto mechanic can do the testing. So make it easier for people to test and maybe make it the cost more reasonable. Is this something
I can tell you from experience in Medford that if it were that way, you'd have the situation where people go into a shop and they say, we need $300 worth of repairs before we can issue a ticket. At least going to DEQ, $12 or $15, and they'll tell you right up front, if you don't pass, they don't collect the money from you. They say, go fix it and come back and see us when it's ready to test again. But I really would have serious reservations about putting that in the private sector, because talking about a group that's unable to police itself in this situation is your mechanics in the garages who would have a tendency to run up the cost on perhaps people low income or fixed income. And I think you'd find out that you were going to have more violators than you would comply with.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chairman, to follow up. I think if DEQ can lift the check off list, those are required to be examined, and let the auto mechanics bid for the authorization to test. So the ones who will charge a reasonable fee will be authorized to be the agent. This way it will make them more available, and maybe the cost will be more reasonable too.
Representative Patrick,
real quickly, Mr. Chair, I do think this is a problem in areas that don't test. This legislative session, we had to re-register my wife's car, and we live in Medford, so we're subject to DEQ emissions testing. And so we had to re-register midway through the session while we're here, so we had to drive up to, up north in Portland so we're going to get the DEQ testing. So we've experienced it firsthand. It becomes a problem. So I understand where you're coming from.
Okay. We're going to recess the hearing on 2637. And I'm going to reopen on the work session on House Bill 2942. We had a public hearing a few moments ago on this bill related to a cap on availability of net lottery proceeds. Representative Lynn Lesquist, would you like to come back up, please? Ms. Lamar.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I was a little confused as to what the impact of this bill would be on bonding capacity, but I got a chart from Representative Lundquist that shows how this is phased in, and I'm comfortable with the fact that, that the state would retain the capability to issue lottery-backed bonds as this is phased in. So that was my one and only concern.
Okay. Representative Patrick.
Chair, just a quick question from Mr. Lamont. I realize that it allows the ability to bond lottery-backed bonds, but if that, what it does is it puts the common school fund then against lottery-backed bonds for economic development or parks or whatever the case may be. Is that not correct? As we move down the line, because that excess money rolls into the common school fund unless it's used for debt service for lottery funding. Is that not correct?
I'm having a little bit of difficulty answering that. I think it's not correct.
Okay.
But it would depend on the perspective of the person looking at it to some extent, because if in fact lottery-backed bonds are issued and that increases the debt service, that would reduce the amount that is going into the common school fund. But on the other hand, there's flexibility within the dollars remaining in terms of how those dollars would be used. So it may or may not.
Well, the representative raised an interesting point. I'd like to clarify this. Now, if money set aside at the 5% level went in the common school fund, the 5% that they claimed is for that portion of the common school fund plus the interest derived minus 5%.
Mr. Chair, no. The way that it works is that there's, let me see if I can describe this. The way that it works is you start out at $350 million.
Okay.
Assuming nothing else changes, that there will be a 5% reduction in the following biennium, and then a 5% reduction to that balance the following biennium, so that it's not always 5% to the 350, but a declining, but 5% to the declining balance in the available revenue. And that would be then affected by any lottery bonding that was done where there was debt service that would reduce that 5% in essence. But the interest earnings would be to the common school fund.
That's right.
On the 5% that's transferred.
Okay. Representative Butler?
In light of this, just one question to Representative Lundquist. Representative Lundquist, what's your understanding that this bill would have then on the effect of future economic development infrastructure lottery bonding? Would it damage the ability to do that?
No, Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, again, all of the first section talks about of the bill, that the first thing they have to do is pay off the lottery bonds, and so no, it does not affect that. It could still happen.
So for future projects in three biennia from now, if you went 20 biennia, at 5%, but in three biennia or 10 biennia from now, if we wanted to put a gas line through to a different basin than the state, so that perhaps Burns would have natural gas as well. That's country.
It has natural gas already. Senator Timms is there.
It's going home, sure. But if we were to develop a project that would do that, then it wouldn't. This program would not preclude us from issuing those kinds of bonds and servicing the debt on those bonds.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Butler, that is correct.
Thank you.
Senator Kutas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But as I add, this is a 20-year program. Robin just told us that...
I misstated. It actually is 5% of biennium, and it's 5% on the declining balance.
Oh, instead of 5% per year?
Per year, yes. Yeah. And it's, so it's...
What do you mean biennium?
Yes. Yeah. 5% of biennium. So in 20 years, there would be a 50%.
Could I turn that out? I think this scenario would help the committee.
If it is to reduce $350 million, 5%, then it will be 50% after 20 years. So since it's a declining remaining balance, it is not going to be that much.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, it's
yes.
sort of reverse of the compounding interest, if you take it the other way. Because it does point out interest in how people teach out. But, I didn't run this out to what it would be in 40 years, but in the period we have before you, there's a 20-year cycle there. Because it's a biennium, plus the fact it's a 5% of the new cap each year, or each biennium, rather than 5% of the original cap, as the committee staff described.
Representative Patrick.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to reiterate what I said previously. Now that the full committee is here, I have concerns about that this is going to pit other funds versus the common school fund in terms of NLRI-backed bonding, whether it be for parks or economic development or whatever, that's going to be perceived as taking away from the stabilized common school fund as a political issue as we move forward. Secondly, we have a lot of programs that are funded through lottery dollars, whether it be small business development centers or other types of programs that are out there, that this will be a declining source of revenue that's available for, I think, some very important programs that are occurring statewide. And third and finally, I'm not convinced that the Common School Fund is the best place to put this. I support schools very well, but in terms of putting it in the Common School Fund, that Common School Fund is then controlled by the state treasurer, the governor, and the secretary of state. It takes that money away from the hands of the legislature to be able to deal with issues and problems that come up. And frankly, I'm concerned about the politics of what's going on with that in light of the budget negotiations, where there were $40 million that was kind of offered up as a general approach, and then it was intimated to me through some sources that maybe we could get $50 million out of it if the number was brought up high enough. And I think it's unfortunate that that's being used as a political punching bag for funding education. I think we should do what's prudent with the fund, and that's what we should try and do. So for those reasons, I can't support the bill at this point.
Okay, Senator Cusack.
Just to add a little bit further to that, not only was there reluctance to allow an additional $10 million to $50 million, there was a reluctance unless a certain amount of money was spent on schools that even $40 million would be given toward the whole talk for schools. So Representative Patrick is right that it becomes a political football, unfortunately, by doing this. And actually, I think that what it does, it begins to which is already occurring. Education is pitted against every other thing in the state already because of fighting for funds. But then what the lottery was originally set aside for was economic development. Now we have all kinds of other definitions, which the legislature, you know, in their wisdom, and the voters have decided they want to do it. But I think it is an excellent resource for economic development, and we should maintain the ability to be able to use these funds freely for that kind of thing.
Okay, further discussion. Excuse me, we're in the work session. So, does the committee choose to take action? Senator Lim.
I have a lot of thoughts on this year, 2019. Sometimes it might be a good idea to put away money if the legislator that the couldn't control of the money. Otherwise, they are ready to spend all the money. They spend the safe money, and we have to pay that with a large interest, and then a retiree fund. They spend the money, and then we have to pay that. Sometimes it might be a good idea to put the money away to make sure no legislators go and get the money out of the weeds. So maybe we are spending just 8% of the total amount of going into education anyway. So just putting the additional money into it, make sure that the legislators couldn't use it. So it seems like a good idea. It doesn't take the money away. It's 5% of the increasing amount of money, so I'm going to support.
Excuse me, Representative Beck.
I'll move House Bill 2942A gross to the full committee with your pass.
Representative Beck now moves House Bill 2942 without amendments to the full Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
No.
Me?
No.
Lynn?
Aye.
Duke?
Aye.
Beck?
Aye.
Trader?
Aye.
Butler?
Aye.
Patrick?
No.
Dark?
Aye.
Aye. Most passed.
Can you carry it?
Senator Gates, would you like to carry it?
Sure.
Is she on pole?
No, I'm not on pole.
Oh, that's okay. I can tell you on pole.
All right. And it's been through the
house. It's been through the house.
Great. Thank you.
Okay.
Close
the work session. House Bill 2942. Open the work session on Senate Bill 1212. We just have some amendments. Oh, Representative Lewis, we'll go back to House Bill 2637 and open the hearing. We had a hearing on your bill this morning. Mr. Bassinet, representing your office, came in and indicated you were on your way, so we just recessed and we'll reconvene here so we can take your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair of Committee. For the record, I'm Leslie Lewis. I'm a state representative in District 29. And I thank you for having my bill up this morning and Senator Duke's bill. We've worked on this a lot of years together. I want to just go over some things about the bill that may not have been addressed this morning. I understand that DEQ testified that 40% of the people in the Columbia County and Yamhill County commute. And that is true. The numbers do show that level of commuting. However, what the committee needs to know that I'm sure DEQ didn't tell you is that we are talking in terms of numbers, very small numbers of cars. The entire Scappoose area, we would be talking population track numbers of approximately 6,000 people, and the portion in Yamhill County is 3,000 people. So you add those two together, you get 9,000. 40% of that is, and I'm not doing the math quickly this morning, what around 3,500? We're talking a small impact on an area the size of Portland that has probably 900,000 vehicles. In fact, I made the calculation of the total Portland ozone maintenance plan. Yamhill County and Columbia County, our two little portions of the plan, represent less than 0.25% of the entire emission reduction strategy for VOCs. And what we have simply asked is for fairness, Mr. Chair, for our people who do not commute, for our retirees, my area, and I can't speak to Columbia County, but my area has a lot of farm workers who live and reside in Yamhill County and work in Yamhill County. They tend to have older vehicles. It's a hardship on them to have to commute up to the Portland area to get tested. And we are simply asking in House Bill 2637 for the opportunity for those people to have a little check mark on the form when they register their vehicle to say that they do not work up in the Portland metro area, and for them to you know, write down who they're employed by or write down that they're retired. And that is all that we are asking for. Currently, as I mentioned, there's only 3,000 people in the Yamhill County area that fall in the testing. The mailing now goes out to a city, the city of Newburgh, that has a population of about 16,000. But those people are not in the testing. But because it's the same zip code as the other 3,000, they all get mailed the list. So they're already on the form. It's a little check mark to say, I don't live in the vehicle inspection area. So 16,000 people already get to put a little check mark that they don't live in the vehicle inspection area. And all we're asking is for those that do live in the vehicle inspection area but don't work in the Portland metro area to have that same opportunity. We think it's a fairness issue. Up in Columbia County, they have, about a 38-mile round trip to get to the nearest testing station. My folks have about a 20-mile round trip to get to the nearest testing station. And we think it's a fairness issue and would urge you to pass House Bill 2637.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand why you brought this forward, and I concur in many ways. And in fact, where I used to live and where my parents still live in rural Washington County, all my growing up life, we were outside the testing area. But we're not anymore there, outside the testing area. They expanded it, so everybody in that rural area, the farming community that doesn't drive into town at all, or the same situation that you're under. And Yamhill County has already enveloped most of rural Washington County. And my whole, you talked about fairness, and the reality is that this system's not fair at all. It's not fair to the citizens in Washington County. And because we got seniors in Washington County that don't drive, hardly at all. We've got homemakers in Washington County that have, that drive very little. We have people in Washington County that live close to where they work and perhaps don't even have to get in the car to go to work and commute, yet they have to get their vehicle tested. Inherently, the system is not fair because we test every vehicle to catch a very small number of folks that they're out of compliance. It's not a fair system. I don't know how you make it fair. I don't know if I'm going to vote for this bill. I understand the situation, but I think the whole thing is unfair, and it's unfair for everybody. I almost agree with Representative Beck that this bill statewide, so it's unfair to everybody in the state. Because all it's unfair.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, I would encourage you certainly not to go that route. The fact is that in a very few short number of years, the EPA plans to mandate a low sulfur fuel, and the emission reduction will be huge when they go to low sulfur fuel. There will be no need to test cars at all. I will not be in the legislature then, but I will tell you, I'm sure DEQ will try their darndest to hang on to their vehicle testing program anyway, because it is a source of revenue for them. But there really will be no need once that low sulfur fuel is mandated, which probably be in the mid 2000 decade. There will be no need to test cars at all by that point. But this is something that it is an issue that, as I said, we've worked on for a long time. In 93, the legislature worked on this ozone maintenance plan. And Yamhill County and Columbia County were explicitly excluded from the legislation. They were in the House version. They were removed in the Senate version. That's the version that ultimately passed. And by rule, DEQ expanded the testing to our area. We don't feel that was right. We feel that the legislature clearly stated that Yamhill and Columbia County should not have been in the testing. And I understand, your concern about your area, but at least you are in the Portland metro area and we're not.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would say that we're not. I mean, we're not anymore. Rural Washington County is no more rural. The difference is rural Yamhill County or rural Columbia County. It's just across the Shenandoah Mountains or over 28th Pass Road, and there you are.
Okay, Representative Butler.
I just had a couple of questions for Representative Lewis relative to the DEQ's estimated expenditure of $647,000 to enforce the requirements of the measure. Is that
the legislative fiscal is questioned that. Have you had an opportunity to see that number, Representative?
I have seen it, and I concur with legislative fiscal that frankly is ridiculous. This is often what we see with fiscal statements from agencies who want to kill bills. They don't have that kind of enforcement now with their existing program, and to try to enforce that on you know, 9,000 population of 9,000 when you have, you know, a population of over a million that you're not trying to enforce, I just think it's ludicrous.
Mr. Chair, I just done some quick calculations. That's $72 per person, $1,850 per commuter automobile. I think that we found a much, much cheaper alternative. If we just went ahead and ran the smart city area out here to this particular area, it's going to cost from just a fraction of what this program is going to cost for your DEQ. So it's a lot better program to not have the testing and to run the smart city. I think we found one of the four areas for the smart city to run. Because
Representative, it seems to me one of the problems with testing is the people don't want to drive all the way to Portland to have it tested. It just adds more problems to the situation. What do you think of the idea of privatizing all the testing, so that all the qualified auto mechanics can apply to be authorized to be all the states at the lowest bid, so that it be reasonable too? Would that be a doable option? Well, Mr. Chair, Senator, you may know that we did work on a bill last session to privatize the vehicle emissions testing. It was Representative Loken's bill. It died on the floor last session. She worked very hard on that bill. I was very supportive of the bill. But DEQ, again, put a full court press, as is DEQ's method. If they don't like something, they will work very hard to kill it. And they did kill that bill last session. I think it is something we should, you know, continue to look at. Although, as I said, if we get this low sulfur fuel, the best thing for all the citizens of the state of Oregon is to eliminate vehicle emission testing entirely.
Okay, further questions?
So, but that will be quite a few years to come yet. But in the meantime, this will make it so much more convenient for the citizens and still maintain air quality. Mr. Chair, Senator Yeek, that's true, but now we would not have an opportunity to try that again in such a session. And frankly, I think Representative Loken is still very interested in that concept, but her bill was, you know, defeated last session. I think she chose not to work on that this session. I didn't know she had a bill.
That is your job.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I want to say about the privatization. If we would privatize by allowing some company to bid to take over the stations that exist rather than have them in mechanics places of business, because the example that Representative Butler gave in another state is that they gouge you for other reasons, or they can gouge you. But if they took over simply some of the stations that we have, that's something that I would very much support, because then we could probably run it for better. But Mr. Chair, are we in work session?
Yes.
I'll move.
Just move for exception motion. Senator Lynn?
Representative Lewis, I do appreciate the testimony you have given to us about that. We had some discussion concerning some senior citizens and who can afford to pay, or they use their vehicle in a very limited sense. I don't think it's fair. We have to ask them to go to their DEQ, pay the amount. And are you willing to support your amendment, such as maybe 7 years for them, or the senior citizens give an exemption in DEQ assessment?
Senator, if I can, we've been instructed in our deliberations on this bill to not amend it.
I'm just asking.
I know, but I just wanted to make sure you knew the parameters
I knew.
That we've been given by the co-chair.
Yeah.
I think
she's going up the question, right?
Well, she's down my job description. But what I would like to say is that I think it's a very valid point that you raised. But I think it should be discussed and debated in the larger context. We have senior citizens in Medford, too, that are required to get their cars checked. And somehow and sometimes have to spend great sums of money to get their vehicles brought up to speed. The typical new car is good for about 8 years before it really starts turning bad. But there's a lot of people who keep vehicles for longer periods, and they're the ones that are somehow being hammered on this inspection, because most new cars go sailing through without any qualms at all. But I was trying to answer this gentleman's question that we've actually been asked to confine ourselves to no amendments on these bills this morning.
What full name is up there, at least? Can I ask?
Yes.
Just opinion?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chair, Sarah Lynn, I think that would be a bill that I would encourage the legislature to take up, at another time. I think it does raise, a question, of the expense, and many of these retirees don't drive very much, even though they may live in the Portland metro area. And I would encourage you to introduce such a bill, and if I were here to help you, I'd stand right beside you and fight for that.
That's good enough. That's good enough.
Senator, that was part of the bill that got veto message. We had the elderly and only income in that one.
And the veto.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got a message.
Like
that
way.
Thank you very much. Senator Kitta.
2637
Senator Kitab now moves House Bill 2637 to the full Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? If not, would the clerk call the roll?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mine's a courtesy. I reserve the right to vote differently on the floor.
Lynn?
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Yes.
No.
Schrader?
Aye.
Butler?
Aye.
Lewis?
Aye.
Star?
Aye.
Cannon?
Aye. Motion carries. And this bill, has it been through the House? Or?
Yes.
It's been through the House?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Senator Gish, would you like to share it?
Sure.
Being from one of the sponsors in the area affected, and I can carry it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We're going to open the work session on Senate Bill 1212. We're going to get this done fairly rapidly. Mr. Nelson, if you'd come up front, please, representing the Oregon Dairymen. Senate Bill 1212 is a bill that passed the Senate and was amended in the House, and the bill has then been sent down to Ways and Means because of potential fiscal impact. And there are some proposed amendments along with your package here. On page 3 of the print of being gross bills, delete lines 33 through 45, and delete pages 4 through 16. There was amended in the House provision that sets up a control of milk and how it's marketed in Oregon. The original bill dealt with the issue of prohibiting the sale by dairies of raw milk. And because it was a vehicle that had a relating clause in the House, some additional other language was added to it, and we've been asked by the leadership and the co-chairs to remove the additional verbiage that's been added and restore the bill back to its original form, and then hopefully move
back to the process that you currently have. So, Senator Duke.
Mr. Chair, I really like the additional language they added. Do we get to know why we have to take out?
Mr. Nelson, would you like to? I think it has to do with the survival of the bill. If it doesn't come out, it doesn't survive. I can be no blunter than that.
Jack and Sue, I cared about the rest of the village. We're in Tillamook County, where there are more cows than there are people. And being able to survive in the dairy world is critically important to that county. And we're definitely losing our advantage. So that's why the comment.
Mr. Nelson, would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dave Nelson. I represent the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association, and with me is my job shadow for the day, Lisa Mizay from Tillamook County, who is the current reigning Oregon Dairy Princess and a student at Mount Hood Community College and with her sights set at Oregon State University. So I've invited Lisa to job shadow with me today. Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, prohibition on unpasteurized milk sales passed the Senate. At our request, the House Agriculture Committee included the Dairy Marketing Compact authorization for Oregon to participate in the Western States Dairy Marketing Compact, which is a marketing structure that supplements the federal pricing system currently in effect. It was strongly opposed by the processors and retailers simply because it stabilizes milk prices to dairy farmers. There became clear over time that there was not enough support in the House to pass that measure, though there was enough support in the Senate to pass the compact. So we decided that in order to preserve the prohibition on sale of unpasteurized milk, that we would take out the compact language and bring it back in the 2001 legislative session.
Okay, Representative Carr.
Thank you. So, I have a cow to make more milk than I can drink. I can't sell it to my neighbor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carr, that's correct.
Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, relative to the issue of the pasteurization of milk relative to the manufacture of cheese, I need to have some clarification there. With mandatory pasteurization, and I understand that there's a lower level of temperature for pasteurization potentially available for certain types of cheeses. Is that where do we stand in that regard under this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, most cheeses are manufactured with pasteurized milk. However, Tillamook, for instance, uses a different heat shock process in manufacturing cheeses, and they're satisfied that the language in Senate Bill 1212 accommodates that manufacturing process. So there should be the only cheeses that would be prohibited under this process were some of the white cheeses manufactured or made personally by some of the Hispanic employees who work on some dairies who make a Mexican style white cheese that has been found to have some E. coli contamination incidentally.
Okay,
just by way of follow up.
Yes,
Mr. Chair, I do have this, and I want to make sure that it's been addressed somewhere in the previous hearings. There are certain religious orders that make their own cheeses and have those cheeses available. We're not speaking now of the white Mexican cheese or the crumble cheese. We're talking now of some of the more solid aged cheeses, specifically amongst our Mennonite population. Would this preclude those folks unless they have pasteurized or at least the shock pasteurization available to them, would that preclude them from selling their cheese?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Ron McKay from the Department of Agriculture Food Safety Division is here. I personally am not familiar with that particular incident. Mr. McKay may be a better one to answer that question.
I'd rather not put this into a full-blown hearing now. It was indicated to me by the staff or yourself that adequate votes existed and we were supposed to take the amendment out and everybody had reached a compromise on it. And it appears right now it's blowing up. Because if we move to a whole bunch of questions, the co-chair said, go ahead and hear it as long as you take the amendment out. And if we start down that path, I'm just going to move this on to the next bill.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I might say that the bill was thoroughly discussed in both the Senate Agriculture Committee and the House Agriculture Committee regarding those issues.
And the House Agriculture Committee added the amendments.
They were, yes, they did.
I have no problem.
And they were unacceptable to the majority of the House.
I have no problem with the bill based upon the testimony that has been previously given in this chairman.
Senator Keith, did you have something?
Well, I did have a question about, because I've been on any of the hearings, obviously this is a perceived public safety, public health issue here with pasteurization, but I'm just wondering how many people will be affected. I know there are small family operations that sell raw milk. In fact, I believe there's this one in my district that sells raw milk, and that this essentially puts them out of business.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bakuta, our information to the Department of Agriculture is that there are no licensed dairies selling raw milk left in the state of Oregon. They have all gone out of business, and that's why we bring you the bill, is because following the 1995 legislative session, when there was the Thomas Dairy incident where there was E. coli illnesses south of Portland that were because of raw milk, contaminated raw milk. All of those dairies have gone out of business, and so we brought the bill to you this session to say that since they are out of business, let's just close the door and leave it closed.
Well, I want to clarify this question because I think this is something Representative Starr was trying to get at. Sam, your next door neighbor, and I have two cows, but I'm not a dairy. Okay? Am I prohibited from selling raw milk to you?
Mr. Chairman, the answer is yes. The way the bill is written,
that's a problem.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you say it's going to put all these dairymen out of business. It's going to put out the one and two cow person, and what happens to goat milk?
Mr. Chairman, the goat's milk is unaffected because we represent cow dairies and chose, because of the one remaining goat dairy that's left in the state, which is in the Medford area. There's one woman who has a small goat dairy down there who has said she wants to get out of the business but currently is in the business. We did not want to put her out of business with a cow dairy bill that's intended to deal with food safety in cow dairies. Now, as far as the individual, the way the bill is written says shall not offer for sale. That individual can give you the milk if they have excess.
Senator Duke.
I can swear the last time I saw this, goats weren't in it at all, and now the goats are littered throughout this, because I remember that there were one or two people who were still selling unpasteurized goat milk, and there are people who claim that they can only drink that stuff or that it's more healthy for them. There hasn't been a problem that I know of with goat milk, and now looking through this, goats are included, except that then there's an exemption down here for goat and sheep. I can imagine milking a sheep.
Right.
But that if there is, for a little life, except that if not more than one reactor animal appears when the goat or sheep food is tested for brucellosis anyway, they can destroy the animal. If we really didn't want to touch goat and sheep, we would have left goat and sheep out of the bill instead of setting up the hoops for them. So, I was on the Senate Committee that heard all of this stuff, and I'm still convinced we need the compact, but if we're going to just deal with the milk, I'd rather just deal with the cow's milk.
Okay, Representative Starr.
I just briefly, I know we're going to move on this bill, tell a little bit of story. I grew up on a small farm. We had two cows. I grew up milking those cows, and we had more milk than we could drink in our family. I had three brothers, and
We supplied probably a dozen families with milk. And we didn't pasteurize it. We strained it. To my knowledge, we didn't have anybody ever get sick drinking milk from the Star Farm. Before I didn't support this, moving this on, I got really good information about what kind of public safety concerns there are with families that have a family cow or two that make more milk than that they can drink themselves.
Representative Schrader.
This is a simple bill. This is now 1999, you know, it's not 1953 or 4 when you and I were little, and,
We were given selling milk in the 70s and 80s.
But the point being, times have changed. We've had some incidents where dairy farmers are getting a black eye because of this sort of thing. It occurs sporadically. The fact that Star Farm or Schrader Farm or whatever never had an incident is pure luck. The bacteria are out there. There's some very serious communicable diseases that can be spread in milk. And this is, we're coming into the new millennium. I think the dairy industry would like to be able to compete on a national and international basis. I think that we're at a point now where we have to do what's best, I think, for the state and the country as a whole. And pasteurization is a non-invasive way that does not denature the quality of the product at all, but ensures the safety of the product to everyone in the state of Oregon, everyone in the nation. And I think it's a real straightforward process. Either we believe that's what we're trying to do here. Nothing precludes the little guy from doing whatever they want, but it's dangerous. It's flat-out dangerous. If we want to sanction that or encourage that at great risk and penalty to the industry as a whole, I think that would be bad policy. So I think it's time to move forward a little bit. There's nothing, no hidden intent here. It's just to make the industry safer, make it productive, and do what's best and safest, I think, for all the citizens here in the state of Oregon. A little different than the industry.
Okay, further discussion. Cindy, good job.
I have a question, and I really am concerned about public health and safety and support dairy farmers. I would like to follow up on the actual public safety group, because often we are told, fantastic stories, and when you really go back and look at the data, it just isn't there. I mean, we're spending all kinds of money to save a life and changing, all kinds of things that preclude others.
The chair is going to take the liberty of appointing the subcommittee, Representative Starr and Senator Duke. You can address the goats, and Representative Starr can address the pasteurized milk, and to meet with Mr. Nelson. We are going to be meeting tomorrow after the poll, and then at 9 o'clock on Saturday morning. And so if the sooner you get your proposals worked out and the differences, then we can move ahead. But right now I would indicate that there's probably been far more questions raised than has been answered.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me. Lamb's looking good. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1212. Open the hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3615. We'll try to move fairly rapidly. This is a bill that originally set up, we had a hearing on it, and it set up a 5-member PUC. The sponsors of the bill have went to the governor and been working in conjunction with the governor on language that would retain the 3-member PUC, but that the chairperson would be appointed by the governor. I don't know. There's some other changes. Would you like to speak to those, Rick, before we open it up here?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, in addition to the changes that Senator Hannon just pointed out, excuse me, it also required the governor to appoint an interim task force you study the structure of the Public Utility Commission and determine whether changes to the structure of the commission are necessary. And then it also allows members of that task force to receive compensation and expenses and requires the PUC to provide the staff necessary. With this amendment, the fiscal impact is it would become minimal, less than $50,000 only for the money for staff and work that task force.
Okay. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Tom Butler, House District 60. It's my pleasure to represent House Bill 3615 as it's with the Dash 3 amendments today. This substantially changes where we were at previously, and I acknowledge that this bill has come a great distance. I want you to know, first of all, that my position should be made abundantly clear that as I have stated in this committee before, we felt like that the job of getting the full workload done and getting it done on a timely basis was of paramount concern. And number two, that the regulatory process appears to be antiquated. We are spending years and years and hundreds of thousands of dollars in the regulatory process and then the resulting litigation that comes out of it. Now with Senate Bill 1149, with the 3% sales tax on certain utilities, the House is going to, that has passed both the House and the Senate, with my understanding, and it appears that at this point the horse may be floundering in this green pasture by the time we're done. What we're asking for is a greater level of accountability and cost responsibility and striving to bring some true accountability back into the issues relative to the Citizens Utility Board for the Public Utility Commission. And this is not directed at any single specific person. I recognize that the news releases and press releases indicate that this is some sort of a vindictive action. If anything, it is a plea, it is a cry, it is an anxious moment for those of us who desire to see some streamlining of the system and have even to look at some of the adjacent systems available in other states that are much more streamlined, where it doesn't take years and years to get these kinds of actions done, and we're just asking for the streamlining. And again, as you indicated, Mr. Chairman, as Mr. Olson has indicated, this particular amendment, the Dash 3 amendment, has the blessing of the governor, and I would urge you in this work session to pass it.
Okay, is there further questions or discussions? Senator Dink.
I was wondering how you envision, you will not have a chairman appointed by the governor, and ever since the people passed this ballot measure, that's all been done internally amongst the commissioners themselves. How do you view the role of this director?
Probably much like originally the bill had proposed that we just have one of the department heads currently existing in government. Mike Greenfield was the natural taking care of so many other departments, and with his prowess and ability to handle so many issues on behalf of the governor's staff. This just says the governor gets the right to go ahead and choose that person who would be the lead person, and then that person would help and assist in organizing and rolling. It's difficult right now to direct the issues relative to how do we get from here to here, and a lot of times the roadmap says, well, you can't get there from here, and so it gives more direction and more accountability as well.
I was just wondering, because I remember the ballot measure when it was on the ballot, and one of the things that at least all the publicity seemed to be concerned about was having one person who would have an undue amount of authority, which they felt they apparently had, with the one person commissioner, and they wanted to go to three so that there would be some balance. But I was noticing that in the language on your Dash 3, you're giving the power to this chairperson to hire, assign, reassign, and coordinate personnel, not something that all three of them who are doing it now would be able to do. I understand that prescribe the internal policy, somebody has to be in charge of that, and that fits what you were just talking about. and who, you know, in the custody and use and preservation of the records. But to give to one person the right, it seems to me the governor would then appoint, which he appoints everybody, so that's not that big a deal, then one person would get to, would have complete control over staff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goose, that's right. You would have a senior commissioner, in effect, that would be really responsible for the agency, much like we have directors in other agencies. And then in the interim, there would be the Public Utility Commission Task Force, which would come back and study the issues as to streamlining the agency and streamlining the rulemaking process and make any other recommendations that the governor may not anticipate as he appoints a head of the commission.
If the task force recommendations, whatever they may be, are never adopted, doesn't this leave you with a distinct possibility that every 4 years you will have a serious turnover of staff in the PUC?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, certainly there could be a very serious turnover, as there would be in any state agency. Perhaps the kingpin of agencies that run this state would be the Department of Administrative Services, and we've seen governors come and go and from different parties, and yet I think today, as I examine the Department of Administrative Services, we probably have one of the most efficient running departments that I've been associated with. And I don't know what the turnover rate is. The people seem to be, we've got great employees that work throughout state government, and I, far be it from me to ever defile those folks. I learned in county government that if you don't support the people that work for you, then you're going to find yourself out in the cold in a hurry. And I do support our staffs, whether it be from the Public Utilities Commission. I think we have some excellent people there. The chances are for instance, some of the people that I work directly with relative to the extended area service issues, they have just been over backwards to try and work with us and have stepped up to the plate in each and every issue. And I'm not involved in any of the political punching bag fray that we've got involved in telephone companies versus the PUC. I do know that in this committee, and I've made it plain and as to my opinion in this committee, that I don't want to continue to allocate a lot more money towards attorney general's fees to take care of lawsuits that we're doing a very poor job of representing the state of Oregon, the interests of the taxpayers and ratepayers in the state of Oregon. And again, with the potential of another 3% sales tax now on certain utilities being sold in the state of Oregon, the pasture is going to get the dream that there's going to be some floundering on. I think that this is the appropriate time and the appropriate forum to go ahead and get this task force up and running so that we'll know what should be done relative to some of the issues, very important issues.
Sarah, I just want to comment. This part gives me serious heartburn. I don't have any problems with a task force. Let's go. We can look at any section of government we want to, and it's appropriate to do that periodically to make sure that they're running correctly. And as far as the governor appointing, we seem to be going that way a lot this session. I happen to have the experience of being in California shortly after the new governor took over. It doesn't matter who the governor was or what party they were. It happens then in California every time they get a new governor. Nearly all of the agency heads had tendered their resignations, and I happened to be involved in fisheries stuff and visiting with the outgoing director. And when that happens, what you rely on is staff. And this bill makes it clear that a new chairperson can move in and replace staff at will. And I'm much more comfortable with the three-member person group, PUC, making staff decisions. It's not fair. This is the Public Utility Commission. This is where we turn to make sure that the phone works and that they show up and repair it periodically or at least install it when they're supposed to, that our rates are protected and those kinds of things. These are the folks that we are turning over to in 1149, the complete rulemaking authority for power deregulation. And they rely to a huge degree on staff. And then to say that the governor is going to appoint and that could be, you know, staff could be replaced and then
what, 3.5 years from now, new governor, new set of staff, could be incredibly disruptive. And I tell you, it happens in other states, and I think that piece would be a real mistake for our government.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. May I just say, Mr. Chair, that I do, again, reiterate my confidence in the staff. Having associated with members of staff of the Department of Administrative Service, the staff of Legislative Fiscal and Legislative Council, I found absolute nonpartisanship in the staff themselves, and that has given me a great deal of comfort. And secondarily, I want to reaffirm and make sure that my colleagues understand my reaffirmation of my commitment to absolutely support and sustain the governor of the state. I have a great deal of respect for Dr. Governor Kitzhaber, and I have a great deal of respect for his intelligence and prowess in this regard. And I would feel much better about this entire issue if I could see the man that I sustain and support as the governor of this state have a greater degree of control than perhaps was envisioned many years ago when the legislation took effect at the polls. So thank you very much.
Representative Schrader.
Are we in work session
yet,
sir?
Not yet. Charlie Davis is here. Longtime personal friend, former PUC commissioner, when it was a one-person shop. Welcome, Mr. Davis.
Thank you. My name is Charlie Davis. I live in Portland. I am the last person who served as a single public utility commissioner for the state of Oregon, or so far as I know, in the entire universe, since Oregon is the only one that had a single commissioner. And I was the first chair of the three-person commission. I have no concern or nothing to say about the possibility of an interim committee studying the structure of the commission. I think that's always appropriate. I assume that the Secretary of State's office has continued to do a performance audit as Secretary of State Norman Paulus did when I was around. But I am concerned that we appear to be moving toward a shadow commissioner, a shadow single commissioner in the form of the governor. I don't know whether that would be bad for John Kitzhaber, but I can testify that it would have been bad for Tom McCall, very bad for the state. It would have been bad for Bob Straub, Neil Goldsmith, Vic Attia, both in terms of the decisions they would have made by virtue of not having experienced the gathering of information at the PUC and hearing the arguments, and by virtue of the political pressures on them. I think Lynn will probably agree with me that in 1975, after hearing in Medford, Oregon, it might have been good for Bob Straub, in terms of his campaign, to have found a way for me to go. But had he done so, he would have had to provide a hearing for me to explain what it was he was trying to get rid of me. But the session we had, I think it was Medford High School, brought out a substantial crowd to say that I was in the hands of the utilities and should be removed. Now, I'm not going to claim that I was the most unpopular utility regulator in those days, but I was.
Actually, I was right behind you in unpopularity. what it was that people accused Mr. Davis of being a lackey for the utilities. I've never known Mr. Davis to be a lackey for anybody. He's been his own independent judge all these years. So.
Well, as I see it, the power given to the governor is more than the power that Norma Paulus or Neil Goldsmith supported in 1986 when they supported Measure 4. And it's more than the power that the people of the state of Oregon thought the governor ought to have with respect to the Public Utility Commission. Questions about efficiency, promptness of decisions, and that sort of thing, I think are perfectly appropriate for anybody to ask and to find out, just as I recall, the Secretary of State, Norma Paulus, asked me. But to give the governor the authority to appoint and remove the chair of the commission provides more authority, more power over this vital utility service than I think the governor ought to have, or than I think the people in 1986 thought he ought to have. I'd be happy to respond to questions. I'm not up to speed on the details of cases pending with the PUC and that sort of thing, but I think those are kind of questions that are perfect for somebody else.
Thank you very much. Are there questions of the committee members? I'd like to ask you a question that I have, and it's part of my concern. When we start putting chairmanships of boards and commissions and an appointment situation, instead of it being appointed by the co-members, are we having a tendency to move towards politicizing those appointments, that only certain kind of mindsets or reflection of certain attitudes will only be considered for those appointments?
Chairman, I think that's inevitable. I don't, and the pressure's on the governor to influence what goes on over there, the decisions, on some issues that may not be central. The pressure on the governor to say, I've got my man over at the PUC, and so nothing bad will happen, so the real cost enclosures in LeGrand. I guess that's no longer a big issue, but there are kinds of political issues that are temporarily very important, but for the governor to exercise that that power over the commission just destroys the integrity of the commission entirely.
Okay. Are there further questions of committee members? Not Charlie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good to see you as always. Is there anyone else who would like to testify? Yes.
In relationship to the last question, currently the commission rotates the chairmanship, and there are two political parties required by law to be represented on the thing, so that both parties have the opportunity to hold the chairmanship. Under this bill, that wouldn't happen.
Okay. Yes, we did in for yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Jenks. I'm the executive director of the Citizens Utility Board. We oppose this bill in the current form. I think our viewpoint is actually fairly close to Senator Duke's. I don't have any real problem with the governor appointing the chair, though I'm not sure that that's necessary. I don't have any problem with the task force to look at it. My real objection is the way this changes the staffing. By having the staff answer to a single political appointee, I think it's going to be disruptive to the process and move us closer to the days we were with a single commissioner. Back in 86, when the voters overwhelmingly approved ballot measure 4 and created the three-person commission, they were really reacting to a series of decisions that had happened not by Commissioner Davis, but by other commissioners that were a very streamlined process. We have a rate hike, and then there'd be a hearing and a process and a rate case to determine whether that rate hike was appropriate. It was streamlined. Voters reacted to that. There was a belief, whether it was correct or not, that utility rates were being set behind closed doors by political appointees. The voters reacted to that and said, no, we want a three-person commission to make those decisions. We're going to require that commission to be made up of both parties, and we're going to try to set up a process that we think is a fairer, better, less political process. What this bill does by changing it so the staff answers to a single one of those three commissioners is much, maybe much bigger than people can sort of intuitively see. Most utility decisions are actually decided in settlement conferences, not through the hearing process. And the staff in that settlement process is representing all three commissioners. If you change the structure so the staff is representing a single political appointee, then that the decisions that come out of that settlement process, where the staff is the one representing the commission, the staff is the one at the negotiating table, can be very different, and it would allow a party, whether that be a utility or an intervener like myself, to go to that single commissioner and cut the deal, and then have the staff pushed out of the settlement conference. And we think it does disrupt. We think it's important that the staff, when they're negotiating, be negotiating on behalf of the entire commission, not a single political appointee. So our position is, if the legislature wants to address the chairmanship, we'll accept that. If the committee wants to address the issue of an interim task force to study that, We support that. In fact, we over the years have recommended several changes to the process that we think could streamline and improve it. But we do object to the idea of taking all the staff and putting them working for a single political appointee, because we do think that will change the results, that will politicize the nature of the commission. And quite frankly, we think that's a violation of what voters had voted for in 86, and there's been no real basis of discussion that includes the public who voted for this on why there's a fundamental need to change the structure and go back to a more centralized decision-making structure. So we would urge the commission to reject this or at least change the staffing part of it and keep that the way it currently works. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Question? Thank you. There was one other person who raised their hand. Would you like to come forward, please? We're leaving our committee because the floor session's in the Senate and the House, so I'd ask you to keep it brief and perhaps paraphrase what you're going to say.
Yes, Mr. Chair, member of the committee. My name is John Glasscock, for the record, a member of AARP, representing AARP, which has about 430,000 members in the state of Oregon. I simply would say I support the comments made by Senator Dukes and also by Cub with respect to this bill. AARP opposes House Bill 3615. It was not what the voters wanted when they voted 71% to 29% for a three-member commission. We agree that it places all the power of the commission in one person as it was before 1986. And also we agree that we lose the balanced authority that we have now. Prior to 1986, the reason the voters voted for this so strongly for this measure was that they didn't see the process being politicized. And we see this returning if we pass a bill such as this. That's all I have to say.
Okay. Thank you. Is there any further questions? If not, the chair would close the hearing and the work session on House Bill 3615. Is there further discussion to come before the committee? Again, we'll meet after the full committee tomorrow morning, Saturday morning, 9 a.m.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kutub.
I just want the Human Resource Committee meeting after the full committee, too.
Maybe?
I don't know.
We can
excuse
you or something. I'm going to lose some of
your
members. Shame on you.
I know.
Well, all right.
Find me, Mr. Chair.
All right, you're in tomorrow.